Hi, I'm David Haynes, the commentary editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Each week, we offer you opinions from across the political spectrum. Red, blue, or anywhere in between, you can find it all right here. And now, you can have the best of our commentary delivered right to your inbox every week. The real-time opinion newsletter gets you up to date every Tuesday morning with a recap of the previous week and a look ahead at what's coming up. The Real-Time Opinion Newsletter, delivered to you every Tuesday. To sign up, go to jsonline.com/realtime.
In March, Republican Governor Scott Walker said, quote, "Wisconsin's economy is in the best shape it's been since 2000. That got us wondering, is this true? As our PolitiFact team found, it's only half true. The latest figures for unemployment rate, wages, and gross domestic product support Walker's claim. However, the figures for labor participation rate, income, and poverty do not. So we're focusing today's Behind the Headlines on the economy. We'll have three segments, each tackling questions about the economy from a different perspective. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks for tuning in. Before we start examining Wisconsin's economy specifically, let's turn to Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert. During the last Marquette University Law School poll, Craig noticed that our attitudes about the economy tend to fall on party lines. So if you're a Republican, odds are you feel better about the economy since the Trump election. If you're a Democrat, odds are you feel the opposite way. That's not really too surprising, but there's one other thing Craig noticed. Here he is chatting with opinion editor Dave Haynes.
So, Craig, you've been doing some reporting on how views of the economy seem to be shaped through a partisan lens, and you've been looking at the Marquette University Law School poll results. What do you find it?
Well, the first thing is, and this is not a shock, is that the outlook people have toward the economy is heavily dictated by their political party. And we saw kind of a revolution in how people answered this question from before the election in October when Barack Obama was still president. And Republicans, for example, had a very dark outlook about the economy, and Democrats had a much brighter one. And then that completely flipped when Marquette Law School asked the same question last month, and Republicans went from being pretty pessimistic to being, you know, rosy-eyed optimists, and the exact opposite occurred with Democrats. And the only real change that occurred was obviously a different president in the White House.
Right. And of course, Wall Street has reacted favorably to Trump, but the economic signals we've been getting generally are kind of where they've been, you know, decent.
And it's not only, here's the most interesting part to me is it's not only people's expectations about the future of the economy that are dictated by this partisan filter, but it's the judgments they make about how the economy has performed, even in the past. I mean, when they ask in October, when they asked Republican voters in Wisconsin, you know, how do you think the economy has been doing over the last year? They were very negative. But just a few months later, when the presidency has changed hands, they're incredibly positive about the past performance of the economy. So it's kind of like it's not just your mood, but it's also your version of reality that changes. And the interesting thing is when you look at this polling over a five-year period, the patterns in how Democrats and Republicans answer this question completely change depending on the political context. You know, when it's a presidential election season and the person in power is a Democrat, Barack Obama, you know, Republicans get more and more negative and Democrats get more and more positive about the economy. But when it's a gubernatorial election, like the recall election in 2012 and the 2014 gubernatorial election, and the incumbent in question is Scott Walker, who's telling a positive story about the economy, it's just the reverse. I mean, Democrats get more negative about the economy and Republicans get more positive.
For more national news from Craig, download our JS on Politics show. That's available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. All right, now that Craig has set the foundation for how we view economic news, let's actually take a look at what local business owners are feeling. How have things changed for them since the election? And what's their forecast like? Business reporter Rick Rimmel joined editor Jim Nelson with some answers.
Hi, this is Jim Nelson with the Journal Sentinel. I'm here with business reporter Rick Rimmel.
Hey, Jim.
How you doing, Ricky?
Good. How are you?
Good. Rick, you've got a story about the small business community in Wisconsin and some interesting perspectives they have about our president.
Yeah, they like him, in a word. Well, you know, he's a Republican, so businesses tend to favor Republicans. But the support and the expectations for Donald Trump may be exceeding those that business has had in the past for new Republicans coming in.
And this is more than just they like him or they like what they're hearing from him. They're seeing some tangible results.
That's what they say. I talked to five small business executives and owners in southeastern Wisconsin, and every one of them is feeling more optimistic about their prospects and the prospects for business generally since Trump won the election. And a few of them also said, "We're doing something. We're going to buy more machine tools. We've added a few employees. We're accelerating our expansion plans. That kind of thing."
And some of those businesses are taking their actions because of what the people they do business with further upstream.
Exactly right. When I was looking for business executives to talk to, I thought it would be interesting to tap into folks whose business depends on the success or the fortunes of other businesses.
Sure.
So, for example, a local company that redesigns and furnishes in commercial interiors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if business isn't going well, generally speaking, their clients aren't going to be particularly inclined to tap the services of this company. It's called Creative Business Interiors. But what they say is we are seeing companies that had projects on hold. They're now saying, let's go ahead, let's do this thing. And so they feel pretty good about that.
What other kinds of businesses did you speak with for this?
There's another one is a couple of manufacturers,
mm-hmm.
Strohwig Industries in Richfield and Sussex IM in Sussex. Strohwig is a kind of a classic Milwaukee tool and die and machining operation, pretty good size, 100-some employees. Sussex IM is a plastics products manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
Creative Business Interiors and a transportation company, Tax Air Freight.
That's a good combination of a good variety.
Exactly. And then I threw in a tech company, too. Missing the name of it right now, but it's a firm that does outsources computer technology.
Sure.
for their clients.
You know, one of the things that I noticed in your story was one of the people you interviewed said that the Buy American rhetoric that's been coming from the president has sort of rippled through and is actually
right
affecting their bottom line in some respect.
Right, that was Keith Everson. He is the CEO and one of the owners of Sussex IM. So, you know, plastics manufacturing, it's a tough business, and there's a lot of product that's sourced overseas. Everson said that when Trump sort of unleashed this, we'll slap a 20% border tax on Mexico to pay for the wall I'm going to build, that just Trump saying that was enough to have some of his customers and people he deals with regularly get on the phone to him and say, Keith, we've been sourcing this product or that product from abroad. We think maybe it'd be a good idea to bring the production back to the United States.
Let's give you the
what
business.
What can you do for us? Well, they haven't given him the business yet, but they're inquiring about it.
Sure.
He takes that as a very positive sign.
Sure. And also, this optimism and so forth, it's not coming, it doesn't seem to me, from anything specific that the president has done.
No.
Which is really interesting.
Right. And there's that sort of throws a little caveat, too. But it's it's based on the rhetoric.
Yep.
You know, these folks are, they want to see taxes lower. They want less regulation. Trump has talked about that sort of thing, and they're betting that he's going to come through on it. Now, however, another thing that they were looking for Trump to do is to repeal, replace the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare.
Right. Right.
And that hasn't happened. So, you know, maybe this optimism will get tempered.
Right. And also the whole tax reform process, it sounds like that's going to take some time, too. It's very complicated.
It will take some time.
Yeah.
I just want to also mention that what I hear from these Wisconsin executives is it mirrors what's going on nationally.
Sure.
The National Federation of Independent Business, which is a leading small business advocacy organization, for 30 years they've been doing this monthly survey of their membership, and they produce what they call the Small Business Optimism Index each month. The index in December showed the largest jump that it ever has experienced. In that 30 years, and the combined increase from including November and December was pretty striking. It's dialed down a little bit since then, still at a very high level. Another month or two, you might see effects of people realizing that things such as the Affordable Care Act repeal aren't going to be as easy as they thought, and that may dampen some of the optimism.
You know, that index, it sounds like almost exactly how the stock market has fared. You know, went way, way up, and it's been in the last few days sort of having a blah period, but it's kind of interesting.
Business is business.
Business is business. It'll be really interesting also to check back with these folks in, you know, we're almost at the 100-day mark for the administration, you know. At the 200-day, it'll be interesting to see how things look then.
We'll take a look.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Jim.
To find that story from Rick Rimmel, visit jsonline.com/business. Again, it's jsonline.com/business. Coming up after the break, we'll hear from books editor Jim Higgins on a book that chronicles Janesville's attempt at recovery following the closing of the General Motors plant in town. Stay tuned for that.
I'm Erin with the Fort Collins Coloradoan, and we've just launched our newest project, a pod past, if you will, on Northern Colorado history. Dive beneath the surface of our reservoir to the site of an underwater ghost town in our first episode, or check back in for stories that take you back in time. Back to when our picturesque old town streets, the ones that inspired designs for Disneyland's Main Street, definitely weren't the happiest place on earth. Or learn about Annie the Railroad Dog, a border collie who was adopted by Fort Collins' railroad workers and became the city's best-known Depression-era mascot. Look for these stories on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, with new episodes coming out the second Thursday of every month. And enjoy Tales from the Way It Was, a Pod Past podcast.
When General Motors closed its Janesville assembly plant in December 2008, thousands of workers were laid off. Amy Goldstein, a reporter for The Washington Post, chronicled the struggles of the former workers through 2015. That's when she started writing Janesville and an American Story. Here's books editor Jim Higgins talking to reporter Sarah Hauer about the book and his biggest takeaways.
Hi, Sarah Hauer here in the studio with Arts and Books editor Jim Higgins. Today we're going to talk to Jim about a book he wrote about this week called Janesville, An American Story. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Sarah.
So, Jim, tell us a little bit about this book.
Certainly. Janesville, An American Story is by Amy Goldstein, who's a longtime reporter for The Washington Post. Her specialty as a reporter is social policy. And what she did was track life in Janesville, Wisconsin, from the closing of the General Motors assembly plant in 2008 through 2015. she tries to present a picture of the many individual and collective attempts in Janesville to either bounce back or reconfigure after the loss of a major employer. And she hits a pretty sparkling cross-section of Janesville people. There are families where one or more family members worked at the plant or worked at related businesses, because that's a theme of the book is the closing of the plant didn't just affect those families. There are feeder businesses, they're down to the woman with the daycare who closed the daycare because all the unemployed factory workers were at home watching their children. And but she also writes about local business leaders, politicians, high school teachers, and just the many folks who are part of the effort to reconfigure Janesville after that devastating economic loss.
So as someone who's been paying attention to Wisconsin news and who had heard, you know, some of the things that had happened in Janesville since the plant closed, what new did this book bring to the table?
First and foremost, as a book guy and as a reader, she does a fine job of just making this personal. Like there's one family where the dad loses his job because of the layoff. Mom is working part-time at something like $12 an hour, which is not, you know, not the kind of wage that can feed a family or pay a mortgage. They have two smart high school-age daughters who end up working two and three part-time jobs each while also going to high school. And they kind of had to diplomatically get past their mom's pride to take her out to buy groceries for the family. So you get the texture of how families survive in these situations. What she really hits home is, and certainly how I see it, that America hasn't solved the issue of how to replace good, high-paying factory jobs that enabled blue-collar people to make a living. People working at that plant were making $28 an hour. It's hard to replace those jobs. The downbeat part of her book is, as she notes, one of the few things that politicians agree on in a bipartisan way is job training. You know, the solution to closings is let's retrain people for new careers. And both anecdotally and in some survey research she does, she says the evidence isn't really there that in a big way retraining works. Now, there are people here who have retrained and got new jobs, and often at $10 or $12 an hour less than their past ones. So I think what Ms. Goldstein does here is, you know, the texture of what happens to community and the many ways that people try to, you know, the effort really is heroic. And as she describes Janesville, there's a long tradition of cooperation and community effort there. And, you know, many heroes in the book, but no one can really answer that question satisfactorily yet. How do we replace all those factory jobs? How do we recreate that blue-collar middle class?
Yeah, reading your piece about the book, that was one of the things that struck me, was that she made this statement that retraining and setting up community college programs and stuff isn't as effective as it's proclaimed to be.
It's certainly not the panacea. And maybe the most disturbing thing she found in the quantitative research is that to a slight degree, some of the middle-aged workers who retrained for new careers came out making less than some of the other workers who just kept plugging and found other jobs. I mean, that's pretty disturbing. Now, this is one city, it's one set of data. I don't think she would say that's definitive. You know, she's smart enough to couch it as the evidence is thin. But it also indicates that it's not the automatic cure-all. You know, that we, as a society, we have to keep looking.
One thing I was curious about is how did this Washington Post reporter decide to do this book on Janesville?
That's an excellent question that I don't have a complete answer for, only that the Post gave her permission, you know, to keep going there. It may not be accidental that Janesville is the home of Paul Ryan, you know, now Speaker of the House, and that may not be accidental. Janesville was also one of the oldest auto assembly plants in the country. That may have been a factor in this, too. So.
In your story, you drew a very brief similarity between this book and Matthew Desmond's Evicted, which won a Pulitzer this week.
Right.
In what ways are these books similar or different?
The similarity to me is in both cases, both Desmond's book and Goldstein's book, most working Americans are one or two mistakes or bad breaks away from, you know, being on the street. The saddest story here is of a woman who lost her factory job, went to Black Hawk Technical College for retraining, you know, aced the criminal justice, you know, curriculum, was hired in the Rock County Jail as a correctional officer. That, you know, that seems like a success story. Was making less money and working third shift as a third correctional officer, ran into some other problems, including, unfortunately, in her part, a bad decision about involvement with an inmate, and ended up taking her life. And it's kind of a cautionary tale that, you know, we're one, and Desmond, this is all over his book, you know, we can be one bad break and one bad decision away from being on the street. As far as differences go, I mean, Evicted is just, the quality of writing is spectacular in Evicted, and I'm not going to put Janesville in the same category. Janesville is a perfectly well-written, smart book, but the quality of writing is what made Evicted really special.
Amy Goldstein will speak at Boswell Books May 1st at 7 p.m. For more on her book, pick up today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or visit tapmilwaukee.com. That's all for today's show. Again, I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Many thanks to Bill Scholes, Jim Nelson, and Sarah Hauer for producing today's segments. Thanks to guests Dave Haynes, Craig Gilbert, Rick Rimmel, and Jim Higgins. To find the PolitiFact mentioned in the beginning of today's show, visit jsonline.com. If you like staying up to date with the latest information from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, be sure to subscribe to our show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Thanks so much for listening, and tune in next week for more.